And a very warm welcome back to Solidarity Breakfast.
A left response to the major developments in capitalism.
What they trade in is not wheat. They trade in famine.
A little dose of revolutionary optimism.
I think it's really important to sort of express solidarity globally.
It really is a deal by corporations for corporations.
The union forever defending our rights. Down with the black leg.
If you think the ABC's left wing, don't listen to this program.
Solidarity Breakfast, 7:30 to 9 a.m. Saturdays, 3CR, 8:55 a.m. Streaming and 3CR digital, podcast or audio on demand. And of course, the website, solidaritybreakfast.org.au.
Solidarity forever!
Good morning.
Good
morning. Good morning.
You've just woken up. This is Solidarity Breakfast, and of course, in the studio, you've got Annie.
And you've got Matt.
And Tobia.
And it's not so cold. We can warn you that it's actually almost balmy for Melbourne weather this morning.
Yeah, I know. It's quite nice. It's quite a good change to wake up to. Not so bad to get out of the bed.
I could actually hear the birds chirping on the way into the studio.
Even they were happy.
Yeah, they're pretty pleased.
Yeah, okay. We've got plenty of things to talk about. One of the things, where do we want to kick off?
We've been reporting on an issue on Radio Filler that kicked off this weekend that was the police killing of a 40-odd-year-old man called Abderrahim Fakir. Unclear in Bologna, in Italy. So it was unclear as to why he was restrained. Police say that they got a call for disruptive behaviour. And what was the outcome was that this man was restrained, cable-tied hands and feet, and then choked until he was unconscious. Paramedics were called to assist. And these six people just watched a man die in the middle of the street. Since then, mass protests have erupted all across Italy.
And the protest was actually called by the mayor of Bologna, to be as I understand.
Yeah, so quite violent clashes happened afterwards. There seems to be a lot of reporting indicating that the police incited a lot of the clashes, beating reporters from quite large newspapers, beating and restraining students.
Yep.
And this all happens under the auspices of the Meloni government.
I've got a little bit of an update because I'm just checking the headlines from ANSA, which is the Italian national news agency. And this is the headline from the family's lawyer of Abderrahim Fakir. They've undertaken an autopsy. It shows violent asphyxia from compression. That's the headline. And also the autopsy revealed blood in Fakir's lungs and crushing. So that's, I think it's very obvious what that points
and
to.
And the justice that the family's not receiving is emboldened by the 45 bis, this new legislation that basically shields police and emergency service personnel from having their names disclosed. And also initiates a process wherein which this case will be shelved, and within 30 days it's able to be dismissed and not accounted for. So there's been a whole lot of...
So what you're saying, Italy is lawless?
Yeah. So this is obviously contravening almost every human rights agreement, accord, anything that humanity's ever created in order to...
And really what happened, and also recently in Philip, we've celebrated, the founding of through the Constitution. We had the Festa della Repubblica. And what happened was actually against the principles of the Italian Constitution.
This is very similar to what's going on in America at the moment. The Interceptors put out a note to say that the sentencing of 16 people to a combined 560 plus years in prison following a protest last year outside ICE's Prairie Land Detention Centre sparked outrage nationwide. Several defendants are appealing their convictions And the Intercept is using state open record laws to demand access to key documents that may shed new light on what happened the night of the protests. It's quite extraordinary, isn't it, that the misuse of the law. And when I was writing this down, I was thinking it's similar to what was happening in 18th century England when there was over 280 crimes that a person could commit would receive a death penalty for. Now that's a country out of control, one would say, and the Americans are looking very similar. And I guess what's happening in Italy is also a line in the sand.
That's right, exactly. We're seeing a worrying trend here as well with what's happening. I mean, we've just had the Labour conference and all the shenanigans that's going on with that. Matthew, you were keeping a close eye on that.
Yeah, from what I understand, Albo's been keeping a very close lid on debate, and for quite some time, a number of the unions.
I think you'll probably find he's got a large team of public relations people doing that.
All of them holding the lid down.
Someone should do a cartoon.
Keeping a lid on things. Like activists and unionists and have been trying to put together like a number of motions, of pro-Palestine solidarity motions, calling for things such as sanctions for Israel. We've also seen MP Ed Husic quite very recently be very vocal about that, and he's been interviewed a couple of times on ABC to that fact.
That was a Freudian slip, advertised interview.
Yeah, Freudian. I was somewhat revealing, probably, that sanctions should be forthcoming on Israel. And from what I hear, what's been happening at the conference as well, that on the first day of the debate, the topic of Palestine was made way for gambling reform. And also I hear as well that for all the various sort of causes within the Labour Party, they have stalls allocated. Now, all the stalls that have got to do with environmental activism or things around Murray River or Palestine, things of very important significance, are actually being put in quite a bit away from the main centre of the conference. So I think that's revealing.
I think we're talking about massaging the facts. The Bob Brown Foundation reported that after Albo flew into Adelaide for Labor's national conference on the 23rd, their billboards calling for an end to native forest logging were taken down. These billboards were there to welcome delegates with a message the party doesn't want to confront. 80% of Labor voters and the majority of Australians support an end to native forest logging. Their campaign wasn't the only one silenced, they said. Other nature campaign billboards were removed too, while mining advertisements were left standing. Bob Brown said this is Trump-lite behaviour by Labor or censorship of public comment by Adelaide Airport, and they're calling for the reinstatement of their billboards.
That actually reminds me of the talk that I went to last Sunday put on by Friends of Rock Art. As well, they had in attendance the traditional custodians of the land, represented by Raylene Cooper, who's heads the Marajuka Corporation, as well as Save Our Songlines.
Actually, she used to. When they kowtowed, she became a free radical.
Mm.
I know this story. I've been following it for quite a long time. Go on.
Yep. And what you just said, what happened with the billboards, reminded me of something that was said by one of the co-conveners that, yes, the Marajuka has got World Heritage Protection, but they were there at the UNESCO negotiations, I think, sometime last year. And
how flimsy is that protection?
It's very flimsy. Actually, that was mentioned at this talk that Senator Murray White, the environmental minister, had actually intervened somewhat on the behalf of Woodside and the other infrastructure and utility companies that are extracting minerals out of the Marajuka, to actually weaken the protections.
Yeah, yeah. And one of the things that was most shocking coming out of the talk, they get the gas for free. And because they get the gas for free, they don't believe that it's worth their while to do the protections yep. that are already technologically available to them, which yep. would protect
yep.
the 30,000-year-old continuous gallery of human endeavour in Murujuka. The Woodside yep. doesn't think that it's worth their while. So what we're saying is that corporations are on one side yep. of the ledger when it comes to human endeavour, and we're all on the other.
Yeah, and this is technology
that's available.
Yeah, that's available, and which is called scrubber technology, which has been used in Europe to eliminate acid rain. And Woodside keep on claiming, we can't put this in. Technology in place could have make our project
but
unviable.
Worse.
Well, I mean, if you're getting it for free,
yeah,
any small cost is
it's too much. And for worse, our federal environment minister is an enabler, not a minister for the protection of environment. And just a very small thing to finish off with. This is just a very small kind of thing. Last week there was the 4th anniversary of the Sydney Road Accessible Tram Stops campaign, and that's when they put in the they're going to do this development, which the Skyrail, which is going to start in 2028. And so during that whole period, the people who have disability or difficulty getting onto trams will not be able to access the trams, okay? And this is what the campaign's about. Now, going into the there's recently that the Labor government's committed to development funding, in inverted commas, for accessible tram stops on Sydney Road, right? Now, that registers a win. But what they've discovered in the past is that they put money into a development fund, but when it comes to the delivery fund, there's no money available. The cupboard is bare. And so this is the cynical people amongst us see this as being a necessary public relations activity from a government when it's been going into an election. So you should keep your eyes out for these PR activities that these people think yep. are okay, but in actual fact, in the real world, public transport is not an added extra. It is an absolute necessity.
And just looking into this, just a reminder that the actual Disability Discrimination Act came into being in 1992, and it requires that all tram stops must be fully compliant with disability standards for accessible public transport, which is regulation that came in 2002, by 31st December 2022. So
there you go.
There, see, this is and this is just information I gleaned from Victorian government's website around the regulations and accessibility trans services.
We've got to massage the facts.
Yeah.
Massage the facts.
At least for once we can end the news headlines on a bit of a win. This headline that says Woodside humiliated as Supreme Court dismisses the trial of the Woodside 3, a slap suit in less than a week. Activists who put a stink bomb in the Perth offices of Woodside in 2023 and had been pursued in the courts by Woodside this week had the case for information disclosure regarding the planning of the event that caused the evacuation of the building thrown out.
Yay!
So at least a little celebration in that regard.
That's a throwback. I remember people in the anti-apartheid movement a long time ago talking about a little action of the same sort going into a bank, you know, sidling in and sidling out.
We'll also see what the courts are having to deal with when there's an actual bombing attempt at the Invasion Day rally that's received almost no media coverage and has almost no weight in the media.
Mm. Oh, you're on Solidarity Breakfast with Annie, Tobiah and Matt. We're going to go to Voices for Palestine.
Okay, thanks. Yusuf is going to tell us a 3-minute short story to finish up.
Yes, thank you. I wanted to talk about the role of arts in times of darkness. I myself have a humble experience in music and creative writing in Arabic language, and it makes me think of, you know, why Palestinians in Gaza think of poets now. There was an academic, Riyad Mansour, in Gaza, who wrote in Arabic on Facebook the 6 or 7 months of the genocide, saying, "Where are you, Mahmoud Darwish? Why don't we have another Darwish?" Darwish is a Palestinian poet who lived from early 40s until 2008, and who gave Palestine a voice on, and he took us to higher skies. In times of darkness and genocide, and the more you rationalize with your reality, the more your hearts and minds and souls feel like they're gonna fall apart. The more you need satire and theater and dancing and music and black comedy and poetry and dancing and any form of art. And that is something that not just Palestinians have resorted to, but also civilizations since the beginning of dawn, whether the disaster or calamity or darkness or hardship is because of a natural disaster like the flood or war, the immediate response, by the, even before the dust settles, is a black comedy joke, is something like a song or a poem or something where maybe a hymn or a lullaby that, you know, puts you to protect your soul. And Darwish, again, I'm referring to Darwish, was in Beirut in 1971. And he was 29. And it was his first time in Lebanon. And it was his second year out after he had left the so-called Israel. First to Egypt and then to Lebanon. He was known to a few writers in the scene, but he's used to going unnoticed wherever he goes. And then he attended in Beirut, in one of the churches, a contest or a competition of poetry for young poets. And he was taken to this local event by a local Lebanese slash Syrian poet called Adonis. And not expected to be known, the nun, or just one of the workers of the church that organizes the poetry contest, when she heard him introduce himself as Mahmoud Darwish, she immediately said, "Mahmoud Darwish, the Palestinian?" He said, "Yes." And she said, "I've been looking for you for 4 years." Imagine somebody says that to you, "I've been looking for you for 4 years. I needed to talk to you after this ends." And then she said, "I was in Jerusalem in 1967 during the Six-Day War when Israel invaded and occupied Jerusalem and Gaza and West Bank and Golan Heights and Sinai. And my role from a Levantine church happens to be in Jerusalem church to provide services, sometimes in Jerusalem, Damascus, Beirut, but I happen to be in Jerusalem when the war broke out." She's Lebanese. And she said, "During the war, my tasks or my duties became to accompany the severely injured Palestinians who have no hope of recovery, terminal, so that they don't die alone. So anyone in hospital that has no relatives next to his or her bed, we were delegated to be next to them so that they don't die alone. And I happened to be sent next to the bed of a young Palestinian boy or young man from Jerusalem. And it's very hard situation to accompany and to comfort somebody who has few hours or few minutes or even few days to live." And she said, "Can I bring you anything? Can I bring you chocolate, drinks, cigarettes, anything?" And he said, "Can you go to the old city and you go to a bookstore? There is a book called by a random person, Ahmed Darwish, Muhammad Darwish, Mahmoud Darwish, I'm not sure. It's called Birds with No Wings. Bring me that book and come back. So she had no idea what the book was about and the poet, and she found it and came back. And it was one of his earliest collection of poetry, that poet. It's called Tuyur Bila Ajniha, Birds with No Wings. And it describes what it means to be stateless on your own land. And that young Palestinian man said, read until I die. Read until I die. That is the role of poetry in times of art. And by poetry, I mean music and such any form of art. And that is what we need to remember when we are busy talking about political and discussion, which is important and must continue. But we have to also remember storytelling and art and poetry. Because like they say, poetry, that's not my quote I'm referring, poetry heals the wounds inflicted by reason. Poetry heals the wounds inflicted by reason. Shukran.
This is Birigan from Bulagan, coming live from the occupied territories of Gumbengi Country, Nambucca Heads, New South Wales. You're listening to 3CR Radical Radio.
And you're with Annie and Tobias and Matthew on Solidarity Breakfast this fine Saturday morning. I had a chat with Professor Hussein Dayar from Swinburne. He's an expert on transport, and the reason why was because of the outage that we had with Telstra outage a couple of weeks ago, and all the trains stopped working. And I asked myself, why is that so? And what would happen if that were to happen more often? And I thought, well, I'll go and talk to Professor Hussein Dayar and find out. Now, the issue at hand was the quite incredible breakdown of the transport system, the trains, etc., after the Telstra outage. So can you explain to people why, in fact, the trains stopped, despite the fact the trains themselves were okay and the tracks were fine?
Yeah, sure. So rail operations depend on a dedicated operational communications that allow the train drivers to communicate with the central control rooms so that they can exchange safety critical information. You know, where is the train? What is the health of the train, the braking systems, etc. So if these communications become unreliable or not available, the operators can no longer be confident that they can run the services safely. As you mentioned, it doesn't mean there was anything wrong with the trains or the signaling equipment itself. It just meant that the communication system to support safe operations could not be relied on, and in that case, suspending services would be the responsible operational decision.
And of course, that highlights to people just how most of our services, our infrastructure, is reliant on what would be called a single point system of communication, the internet that's been sent out.
And that's right. I think the digitalization is becoming the backbone of not only the mobile services that consumers use, but also for some of the critical infrastructure, like, for example, public transport. And the incident showed exactly that, you know, a single software fault in a telecommunication network can have cascading impacts, if you like, across transport, across emergency communications and payment systems. So it is really broader than just losing mobile connections for consumers. That reliance on the digital backbone makes it more important that we put in place measures to what we call to improve the resilience of the network, so that if anything happens, we don't have total breakdown, that parts of the network should still be able to operate or revert to a backup operation.
So do you have any idea, or do they have any idea yet, as to what caused the breakdown, just as a matter of interest?
Exactly. So Telstra identified the problem as a failure involving network timekeeping servers. So these servers basically synchronize the timestamp or the time so that all the other servers are on the same timestamp, if you like. So what has been confirmed is that the outage involved a software defect that affected the time synchronization. But what's interesting is that apparently, and even the Telstra CEO has confirmed, apparently the timing system vulnerabilities have been recognized within the industry for some time. So that begs the question, first of all, we all know with IT systems, there's always backup. So if a server broke down, was there a backup server in place? And if yes, which should be, and if yes, why did not the backup system step in? Like, you know, we see this in energy, for example. We all witness it sometimes during a storm, for example, we lose electricity at homes, and you can feel it, if the electricity goes down, and within seconds, within minutes, the backup generators step in.
Yeah, I was going to say that. I was going to say that backup generators in the old parlance, but this is a different, slightly different technology, isn't it?
It is, but it is the same principle. I mean, there should be the what we call redundancy. So redundancy is to have backup systems. If something fails, and you know, I mean, these are computer systems and digitalization. We all know that with aging, etc., they will fail. But the onus on the operators and the companies is to ensure there are backup systems in place. One conversation that I'm sure the investigation would unveil or reveal, I know the CEO is facing a Senate inquiry on Friday, is it is not also, it is not good enough to have backup systems. So let's say you have a server and then you say, okay, I'm going to have 10 backup systems of the same server. That's not good enough. They need to be diversified. They need to include different parts, because sometimes if you have 10 backup servers that include the same components as the main server,
the same problem,
they're all going to fail, right? So this is where what we call resilience comes in. So you need to diversify the components. Some people even put them in different geographical locations, so that one outage does not affect the other. So we still don't have the full picture, if you like. And I think Telstra is doing an internal investigation, and there are external authorities or regulators doing their own thing. So probably in a couple of weeks' time, we would have more information. But it's looking like a class action taking place, and it's looking that they're going to, Telstra and probably other operators are going to be grilled about how ready they are in case of single failures.
It's interesting, isn't it? It sort of begs the question why it's privatised as opposed to a government or public infrastructure. But I suppose that's a political question. And the next thing, of course, I was just wondering, if it wasn't a different computer setup that was running parallel, what about a wireless setup or something of that sort, if you were talking purely about the trains?
Exactly. So I think this is a very important point. And what we have been calling for is that we need to have different communication pathways. So I hope the future conversation would start to look at not relying on a single technology. So instead of just, in this case, the V-Line and other train operators, they relied on a commercial Telstra network. So in the future, I think increasingly we need to combine mobile networks with satellite communications, and even more appropriately, I think, is private operational networks. So like in Japan with the fast trains, the companies don't rely on commercial networks. They actually have their own private communication networks, and they have more control about what happens to the network and the communications. So the goal is, if one of the pathways fails, like in this case, the mobile network, another pathway like satellite, etc., can continue to support the essential services. It is not necessarily about booting up to exactly the same level of services. I think consumers would be okay, for example, if the emergency services are still, like when you dial 000, it's still working. But maybe, you know, some of the other services might lag and might take a couple
of hours. No, a certain sort of triage of requirement.
Exactly. So I think this should be the next conversation once the dust settles, if you like.
Thank you very
much. Hi, we're from Braver College, and you're listening to 3CR Community Radio
on 8:55 AM.
People are where they are. You're going to have to meet them where they are, and you're going to have to be generous. And that's why it comes back to the idea of friendship. Friendship is never with people who are just like you. What a boring world it would be if you only made friends with people identical to yourself. You know, then again, you might as well have imaginary friends. You want to learn from people. You want to laugh with them. You want to laugh at their limitations. They laugh at your limitations. You grow together, yeah? So politics is also like that. If you're just stagnant, you know, if somebody enters politics age 15 and when they are 35, the same person, terrible. They haven't grown. They haven't shaped themselves. I'm Vijay Prashad with 3CR. You better listen to it because it's really good.
Well, you're with Tobiah, Annie and Matt on Solidarity Breakfast. And last week was the last week for Melbourne Documentary Film Festival. But I had the opportunity to catch up with Senator Pete Wish Wilson. He's the Senator for the Greens in Tasmania. And Lyndon O'Neill, who is a traditional owner. They were at a film called Love Letter to the Unseen. I had a little bit of a chat with them because it was the film itself was focusing on conservationist Spencer Hitchin and his journey of discovery to understand the imminent threats to the endangered Morgina skate. I don't even know how to say that.
Yeah, Morgian skate.
Morgian skate, and the intrinsic beauty of a species that exists both in the real world and in the imagination of its supporters. Anyway, I was asking them about the importance of the issue, and I got some very interesting information from Pete Wish Wilson about the salmon industry in Tasmania.
Peter Wish Wilson, I'm a Green Senator of Tasmania.
Yep. Lyndon O'Neill.
Okay, and we're here at the screening of a very important film about the marine gate. Can you tell me about why it's such a big issue? You're a traditional owner, aren't you?
Yeah, it's a big issue, I guess, because it's one of the many of our ancient species are on the on the threatened list. And that's not just isolated to Tasmania, of course. So always looking for opportunity to come out and support the wonderful work that our conservation people do, and just really probably let the film do the talking tonight, I think.
Yeah, well, the film, A Love Letter to the Unseen.
Yeah.
One of the things in this film is, you say it in the film, but it's obvious just from the visuals, that the marine scape actually is replicated in the landscape, isn't it?
It's an incredible feature, right?
Yeah. I got a bit freaked by that before you even said it. I thought, oh my God, you can see it in the landscape.
Start looking at things a little bit different, right?
Yeah. So. Now, of course, the important thing about this is that it's in this tiny little space in Macquarie Harbour, and it's the same space that a corporation has put up fish farms. You'd think that they could have picked a better place.
Yeah, it's a long story, right? It's just how we've evolved as society, I guess. We've sort of outgrown ourselves in the places that we live. It could be said that at some point in time, you'd say it's an accident, but as time goes on, you've sort of got to start to check in on what we keep doing, I suppose. Yeah, it's just to be kind.
As a Green Senator...
I might just say a few words about what you just said there to Lyndon. Like, in 2012, there was a boutique industry, a cottage industry in place at that time. The Greens and environment groups warned the state government not to expand fish farming in the Macquarie Harbour. We didn't have the baseline data to understand what the impacts would be. It's a very complex body of water. We said it was going to be a ticking time bomb, one of the most endangered species on the planet, the Morgan State. That's exactly the way it's worked out. These salmon farms pump a massive amount of nitrogen into the water. That's from their feed and from their feces. That reduces the oxygen in the water, which is slowly suffocating this species that's been with us since the age of the dinosaurs.
And it exists nowhere else.
There's nowhere else on the planet that this species, this Morgan, charismatic, a little scape is found anywhere in the world except for this one harbour. And the salmon industry kind of rules the roost in Tasmania. They're very powerful with both the major political parties, and it's taken a massive community effort from our First Nations representatives through to conservationists to actually put pressure on them to reduce the amount of salmon in the harbour. But the most recent science basically says you need to get salmon farming out of the harbour altogether.
Now,
it's just not the right place to be an industrial salmon farm.
And recently there was a fallout on all the beaches around there, wasn't there, from that fish farm?
Well, there's fish farms in other parts of the state where we're having mass fish mortalities.
Oh, right.
Where dead fish are literally, and we're talking about not just thousands of fish, millions of fish die in a single mortality event. As the ocean is warming, the oxygen levels are starving these fish. We're having to pump antibiotics into them at record rates, and even have new antibiotics licenses that are now turning up in wild seafood, which is stopping our exports to foreign countries. The whole thing's a disaster, but it was a very predictable disaster because greed and ignorance has got us to this point. Now, this film is really powerful because it's the journey of a young man, Spencer Hitchens, to understand the plight of this species and come to terms with the possibility of extinction from a young person's perspective. And Spencer talks to everyone, doesn't he? He goes and talks to everyone, and it's the stories about his journey, meeting the traditional owners like Lyndon, meeting scientists, meeting the industry, meeting politicians, and it's a wonderfully powerful film.
But he also poses the question about the people making the decision? C5 is very perplexing.
Yeah, look, I'm a politician myself, and I can tell you, very bad decisions have been made on salmon farming in this harbour. In fact, it's been a real problem for our state across the board. That's because the industry kind of gets away with doing whatever they want to do. The government and the regulator have repeatedly failed to hold them to account. And it's only been the community and community pressure that's got Tasmania at a point where we have almost a balance of power parliament, and the government now has to respond to the people and not just the corporations. It's taken years to get to this point, but sadly the state doesn't have a lot of time left. There's not that many states left in the harbour, and the government's got to listen. They've got to listen to the science and to the people.
There's a common theme running in industry in Tasmania. I mean, obviously they constantly say, oh, it's employment, 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 but all the industries are so destructive.
Well, look, every job's important for Tasmania. It is true, and especially in places like down on the west coast, there's not that many jobs left. There's a lot of industries that have traditionally left since globalisation has changed the face of Tasmania. A lot of the mines have shut down, the manufacturing businesses have gone. However, tourism is probably one of the key attractions, and this harbour, the fish farms are very unpopular with wild caught seafood industries. The abalone industry has been up in arms about their impact here. That's also a massive employer in the state. So it's about getting that balance right. But there may be other places to farm fish, but not in this harbour that borders a World Heritage area that has so much traditional cultural value to our First Nations people, as well as it's environmental value.
Is it true that the company that is running the fish farms is actually a bit on the nose in other countries? That's why they've ended up here?
Yeah, well, see, they used to be Tasmanian-based companies, and they've all been bought by big multinationals. And a company like JBS, which is one of the biggest companies on the planet, they're into protein at a massive industrial scale. And, of course, they've been pinged for all sorts of behaviour like corruption in foreign countries. So I wouldn't say they're an ideal model corporate citizen. They've got very deep pockets. And they want to expand the salmon industry. They didn't buy into a small place like Tasmania, without the intention to expand salmon farming. So, this creature has become, I suppose, a rallying point for the community that often complained about the impacts of these farms and the impacts they have on our waterways and on our communities. Will a big multinational like JBS listen? I have my doubts. But at the end of the day, the government's job is to regulate big corporations. Corporations like JBS are set up to make profits, whether it's for shareholders or for their individual private shareholders. It's the government's job to regulate the industry, and that's where we're focused on, making sure the government and the Environmental Protection Agency does their job.
Thanks.
And that means ending salmon farming in the Foreign Harbour.
What happened?
So on the last day of the last Parliament, the government brought in special legislation, a deal between Labor and Liberal, to weaken federal environment laws so that the salmon industry, if taken to court, wouldn't be responsible for what they'd done to Macquarie Harbour. Because under federal law, when a decision was approved by the Environment Minister, if any new information came to light, like 10 years of climate action, climate change, for example, or pollution from salmon farming, the minister could revisit that decision. Well, this new law that they passed, or the weakening of laws, basically stopped that from ever happening. Not just for Macquarie Harbour, but for any project anywhere in the country. New information now cannot lead to a reassessment. And they did this to win the seat of Braddon. They did a deal with the unions down there, and unfortunately they won the seat of Braddon. They got political payback. What's happened since is not only the environment laws been weakened for a polluting industry, but the government's committed $28 million of taxpayer money for a project to pump oxygen into the harbour. They're going to have these diesel barges on the harbour burning diesel on a World Heritage Harbour, pumping oxygen into the water to try and oxygenate it from the effects of the industry. But they've just announced that the contract for that burning, the $28 million to be spent on these barges, is going to go to the salmon industry. So they're going to be doing their own... They're going to be doing their own mitigation and work, and they're going to actually profit from this project. So it's just wrong on so many levels. And people just need to know about it.
And don't buy
Look, I would not be buying industrial salmon from Tasmania. No way in the world. I've been out there and seen the state of the fish. They're pumping antibiotics into them just to keep them vaguely healthy, and they're causing so many impacts on the marine environment. They don't deserve to be supported.
Hello, this is Maluma May from Bulagan, and you're listening to 3CR.
A week solidarity Brekkie team listener went congratulations and a big thanks to all those non-workers contributing to the huge unemployment and underemployment figures. Big thanks especially from Reserve Losses Bank Supremo Michelle Bulldust and caring employers generally, who so appreciate their dedication to addressing inflation, even if it does not prove effective enough to prevent further rate increases. But that would be no fault of the large number of unemployed and underemployed. It would be down to those selfish, selfish workers who are employed, either blissfully ignorant of the hurt or consciously, deliberately hurting their caring employers, who face even more headwinds as the wise practitioners who comprehend the delicacy of the delicate flower that is the economy, the greatest economic order of them all, describe these threats. The bloody socialists are contemplating a new Fair Work, True Blue Aussie, No Longer Work Choices looks like at court to deal with underpayments and other disputes. Underpayments, let's make it clear, inadvertent. Amazing on the law of averages when caring employers get reading and award confused, they never manage to overpay workers inadvertently. It must be something to do with the confusing wording, like it's in English. The court, the socialists say, will have specialist workplace judges, but caring employers know what will happen. It will be stacked with the socialists' evil union mates, expressed as usual by our old mate Industry Profits Group Supremo Innes, will cost the workers. Industry will be understandably dubious about who will be appointed to the new court. Given unions have pushed for this development, there will be unsurprising scepticism about the prospect of it operating in an entirely balanced manner. Great point, Innes. There's no way, unlike the balance the former coalition government achieved over years of appointing only caring employer representatives to the Fair Work, True Blue Aussie, No Longer Work Choices Just Looks Like It commission, able to see caring business class relations from both sides, totally independent people like Sophie Mirabelli Up. The new court would replace the Industrial Relations Court former big Supremo Little Johnny Howhart abolished in 1997. Worth noting, the Fair Work, True Blue Aussie, etc. current commission does not have jurisdiction over underpayments, brackets inadvertent, or the ability to impose civil penalties. Workers must also be condemned for reducing True Blue Aussie to the worst standard of living in a century, the True Blue Aussie Capitalist Review informed us. If only they'd pull their fingers out and do something about their abysmal productivity, maybe work weekends and nights and call for a pay cut so they can have a better standard of living. Someone should point out to supremos who sit in their comfortable offices and send their working class youth off to train kill across the globe that when you invade a people, there's more than a rough chance they will fight back. That the working class youth brainwashed into loving a bit of train killing and the latest merchants of death, kill, 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 gee whiz technology, might consider that instead of train killing, they might well be train killed. Even if these days a lot of killing is by bombing and remote-controlled drones, like this week when US of the UN of the US of the world train killers were train killed after the US of had killed and injured lots of evil Iranians, leading big Supremo Donald Trump or the poor to rage, he would punish Iran. Apparently all those deaths and injuries and destruction of homes and infrastructure evil Iran was responding to were not punishment. Punish evil Iran for daring kill train killers of their invader. Well, they were at an air base in Jordan. The US op has air bases just everywhere, so dedicated is it to world war is peace. They had made the ultimate sacrifice, Donald extolled them. Well, sitting in an air base in Jordan, maybe, but he told the world, it just shows you how bad the Iranians are, doesn't it? Invaded by Donald and his very, very close friend, brackets temporary Benjamin, yet another Yahoo and having the evil audacity to fight back. Speaking of Benjamin, that photo posted by a Zion train killer, the most moral train killers in the world, Benjamin keeps telling us, photo of a Palestinian lying prone on a fold-out cot, naked except for underpants, hands zip-tied behind his back, a cord lashed around his body, and a broomstick slipped through a length of square metal pipe, tying him down to the cot, leading the Zion train killers to assure us, the incident does not align with our values and regulations. In what way? Well, first and foremost, we do not condone these things being published. We have no idea what the train killer was thinking posting the picture. We assure you he or she will be severely reprimanded. What about the poor prisoner? Well, he is a Palestinian and therefore a terrorist. He only has himself to blame. He would not be in such a position if he was not a Palestinian. From Palestine. There is no Palestine. Even more evil, New York Mayor Zahran Mamdani, doesn't the name say it all, says he's investigating if he has the power to arrest poor Benjamin for the war crimes for which he is charged and pack him up to the International Criminal Court when Benjamin attends the UN of the US of the UN of the world in September. Wishful thinking, because he doesn't, but what evil audacity when Benjamin and Donald, who do not recognise the court, want their friends like True Blue Aussie to join them in having it abolished altogether. Indeed, Zion's True Blue Aussie ambassador urged us to do just that, rather than the Socialist Party expressing some criticism of Zion's slaughter, destruction, genocide and starvation. Little matters giving the court the thought that maybe war crimes are being committed. Zion's UNOB ambassador made the sensible response that Zoran Mandani should be arrested. A bit of torture would teach him a thing or two. True Blue Aussie reiterated its support for the non-land, non-people through our Minister for going overseas all the time and being a perfectly good little prefect, Penny Left Wing, condemning Hamas, which, he asserted, continues to damage the prospects of a two-state solution and... she asserted, and reject Zion's right to exist. There, strong support. Penny, can you think of anything else that might be damaging the prospects of a two-state solution? I just said, Hamas continues. Okay, we got it. Meanwhile, as the His Most Gracious Majesty's con mission into anti-Semitism and social cohesion continues to hear its balanced viewpoints, and the anti-Semitism definition proffered by the combating anti-Semitism envoy is increasingly foisted on institutions, the social cohesion bit was emphasised as the combating Islamophobia envoy called for religion, among other things, to be reduced in the definition of terrorism. Efforts to categorise extremism solely by ideology are increasingly insufficient, he submitted, and of course, given the government's embrace of Gillian Siegel's orders, then Aftab Malik's proposals would also be adopted automatically. Well, not quite. But the government is considering the report, Minister Tony Bark worse than responded. But I am comfortable with the definition that we use. Go on. We wonder how much of the final His Most Gracious Majesty's con mission report will address the social cohesion bit. So far, the balanced evidence seems to mean we must, and social cohesion must, embrace Zionism and condone the slaughter, destruction, genocide and starvation, or at least not dare criticise it. Sensation at the Trample the Poor Cup. The World Cup. After the final, when they were forced to bring a giant tow truck onto the ground in a desperate attempt to drag Donald from centre stage in the winner's celebrations and celebratory photo shoots. The disrespect of those who didn't consider Donald the most important feature. Donald knowing the players would cherish forever not winning the event, but being photographed with the greatest big supremo ever as the centrepiece. Got a feeling Donald's very, very close friend might have lost a few brownie points by dragging Donald away from his moment of glory. despite the confected FIFA World Peace Prize and smashing the rules at Donald's behest to reinstate a red-carded US old player, it doesn't take much to undo all your servile bowing and scraping with Donald. I thought the World Cup was shared across North America, Canada, Donald and Mexico, but as Donald grabbed the spotlight, grasping the cup at the presentation, no sign of his Canadian or Mexican counterparts. But there's our silly mistake, of course. Counterparts. Inferiors. There's no comparison. And another exciting Donald first. The first World Cup host, in this case one-third host, to impose himself or herself on the post-match celebrations. Also in the US, I'm amazing the number of people who keep using their cars as weapons against the poor ICE thugs. Sorry, ICE enforcers of US of immigration laws. Presume the E in ICE stands for exterminators. During one of the few footy matches we still get on free-to-air telly, one of the ubiquitous house ads for Farmer Wants a Wife. Heart-stopping surprise. Who will they choose? And I thought, the who bit's right. Who gives us stuff? And don't we feel for poor former Big Supremo Tiny a bit more for the bosses, whose sense of true blue Aussie values has been so abraded? See, the Electoral Commission plans to change the South True Blue Aussie seat of Grey, named after a colonial governor, to O'Donoghue, named after a terra nullius non-land non-person. The very non-land non-people George Grey ensured were non-land non-people. A socialist plot to destroy our colonial history, Tiny was close to tears. These non-land non-people are right up there with selfish workers in bringing this country down. Finally, as the socialist talk fest plots the overthrow of capitalism, academic economist Richard Holden Proppitz warns us of a left-wing tax assault on wealth. If but the socialists were as bad as Richard and Innocent, the caring business class alert us, wouldn't it be wonderful? Good morning.
Oh, good morning, Kevin. It's always a great shake-up to hear your voice on a Saturday morning. You're on Solidarity Breakfast with Annie...
Tobiah and Matthew?
Yeah, that's right. You forgot your name.
Oh, yeah, I forgot my name. Sorry about that, folks.
I went down to the federal court on Tuesday, and it wasn't just a case that was starting up against... the federal minister's decision about the Murujuga art, but also the ACF, the Australian Conservation Foundation, were there calling for a protection of Scott's Reef. The federal environment minister's decision to give Woodside the go-ahead to destroy Scott's Reef as part of a new gas hub on the northwest shelf up to 2070. The case started on Tuesday, and we stood outside in the cold. It was very cold, much colder than today, I have to say, when the ACF's lead lawyer and CEO, Adam Bandt, talked to us about why they were taking the case. We're outside the federal court in Melbourne and it's cold, but of course what they're doing up in Western Australia affects everybody, doesn't it?
Well, absolutely. I was up there not long ago to Ningaloo and saw the amazing diversity of the wildlife that lives there. And there's just not that much of it left now in the world, and we need to save every piece of it that we can. And, yeah.
You'd important. Think it was obvious, wouldn't you?
Yeah, you would.
From 3CR, why have you come out on this cold Melbourne morning to outside the federal court?
Well, we've got to look after what we have. And once things get damaged, it's very hard to bring them back. So, yeah.
Now, people would say, oh, you know, we really need to put really big pipelines through delicate environments for the economy.
Well, once it's gone, it's gone. So it's like the Great Barrier Reef is having a lot of trouble. So we want to save this reef if we can.
So what you'd say, there's no jobs on a dead planet?
Well, that's also a possibility as well.
And I'll just add that it's easier for humans to be adaptable than the animals and the coral and that sort of thing. We have to adapt rather than destroying nature. We've got to really just look after nature. because otherwise it's just not going to be there.
We're just part of it.
Why are you outside the court this morning?
I'm outside the court this morning because I'm a proud Kukulug woman from Kukulug Nation from the island of Musig in Senator Kess, known as the Torres Strait Islands. And climate change isn't something in the future. It's something that we're bearing the brunt of today. And our island communities and cultures are at risk of the seas rising and continuing to take our stories and our song lines and our totems, where we must, as a daughter of the island, and our community, we must do whatever we can to protect our ocean so she can look after us and we can remain on our homelands.
Thank you.
Thank you.
My name's Adam Beeson. I'm General Counsel with the Australian Conservation Foundation. We're here today at the Federal Court because ACF has brought two court cases, each challenging a decision of the Federal Environment Minister. The cases will be heard together during the course of this week. In the first case, ACF will tell the court that it should throw out a decision of the Federal Environment Minister to approve an extension to the North West Shelf Gas Processing and Export Facility. In 2025, the Federal Environment Minister approved an extension to that facility out to 2070. In the second case, ACF will tell the court that it should throw out a decision of the Federal Environment Minister to ignore the climate consequences of this gas processing facility on Australia's precious places, including the Great Barrier Reef. This gas export facility, the North West Shelf, will unleash an estimated 4 billion tonnes of climate pollution over its lifetime. That is equivalent to what the entire population of Australia will produce in a decade. ACF will tell the court that the minister's head-in-the-sand approach to the climate consequences of exporting fossil fuels is legally wrong, including under international law. And ACF welcomes the involvement of the United Nations Special Rapporteur on the human right to a healthy, clean and sustainable environment, and the court's decision to receive the Special Rapporteur's written arguments. But ignoring climate change is not the only legal mistake that ACF will tell the court that the Federal Minister made. Firstly, ACF will say that the Minister was wrong to consider the economic or the supposed economic benefits of the Browse gas field. Browse has not been approved. Browse is an environmental disaster right next to Scott Reef and is facing serious community opposition. You can see it behind me. The Minister should not have assumed this project will go ahead. Also, the Minister gave the green light to the North West Shelf extension without knowing the content of the gas it will process and therefore the pollution it will cause. And finally, ACF will tell the court that all the circumstances around the approval of this project suggest that the Minister might not have brought an impartial mind to it. That claim is based on the long negotiation between Woodside and the Minister's department and the sequence of events leading up to the approval. Litigation is never an easy step, and this is not something that ACF has done lightly, but ACF won't stand by while the Minister makes wrong decisions under laws that are supposed to protect Australians and our precious environment.
Adam Band, CEO of ACF. We shouldn't have to be here today because the Minister should never have made a decision that is going to make climate change worse. But we know what is causing the climate crisis. Coal and gas are fueling the climate crisis, and gas is as dirty as coal. And instead, the Minister waited until just after the election to approve a massive gas export project up on the northwest of Western Australia that is intended to be linked to another massive climate bomb that is going to put Scott Reef at threat. And the emissions from these huge climate bombs are also going to threaten the Great Barrier Reef and make the climate crisis worse. Now, ACF will keep pressing for governments to make decisions that accord with the science. And it's very, very simple. In 2026, as heat records are tumbling all over the place, as people are feeling the effects of the climate crisis accelerating, governments must stop approving new coal and gas projects. The first step towards fixing a problem is to stop making the problem worse. So we're going to keep calling on the government to do the right thing, the thing that the people of Australia want, the thing that the people of the world want. because you can't say that you're trying to put a fire out while you're pouring petrol on it. And if governments don't do the right thing, then we're going to take them to court to get the laws of this country upheld. The court is going to decide the merits of the minister's decision, and we'll leave that to our terrific team of lawyers as they argue our case over the next few days. But what I can say outside of the court case, you just have to look across the country to see the growing community opposition to what this government is doing in making the climate crisis worse by recklessly approving new coal and gas projects. People power is growing by the day. Not only here in Melbourne, but in Sydney, in Brisbane, in Perth, everywhere right across this country, people are realising that governments can't say they're serious about climate action and at the same time keep approving new coal and gas projects. So we're going to keep fighting, and we're going to win this, because this is how we will protect everything that we love about this beautiful country of ours. And I just want to say to all the people who've turned up here so early in the morning, who are representing tens of thousands of people right across this country, and who are taking up the fight on behalf of future generations, all we want is the chance for our kids to be able to go to every summer and enjoy the beach the same way that their parents and their grandparents did. All we want is for future generations to be able to fish in rivers and enjoy all the beautiful things about this country without having to go to every summer worrying about how many people are going to die in the next bushfire or in the next heat wave. And we are going to keep fighting, because what is at stake here is our way of life. We've got science on our side, we've got right on our side, and we've got the people on our side, and we are going to win.
The ebbs and flows that come and go, they're just around the corners that you never know. I'm something to behold, 'cause good things come to those who wait. At least that's what I was told. Now I know. Give a thousand kisses, baby. Take a thousand smiles. Take a thousand inches, babe. I'll give a thousand miles. Tell me all your secrets, baby. I'm all ears tonight. 'Cause I know that this time I got it right. As a matter of fact, it's simply a matter of time. It's not coincidence when circumstance and stars align. 'Cause you hit me like a lightning bolt and shook me to the core. My heart beating like thunder, like it's never thumped before. So now I'm sure. Give a thousand kisses, baby. Take a thousand smiles. Take a thousand inches, babe. I'll give a thousand miles. Tell me all your secrets, baby. I'm all this tonight. 'Cause I know that this time I got it right.
I had a busy week this week. I went off to the AEU, the Australian Education Union rally, which was massive. It was the second mass rally. They had they were most concerned about the general tittle-tattle coming out of the Labor people, spreading rumours about the vote being auspiced by socialists, and that... you know, they're just being ungrateful because they won't take 28% wages increase, but of course when someone offers you 28%, you got to ask, is that because you're really exploiting them? But they were still really riled up because they, as I say in the chats with the different people, they really want transformational change and they are fighting for the life of public education in Victoria. It's the 23rd of July 2026. I'm down at Bourke Street Mall in the lead up to the AEU, the Australian Education Union rally. This is about pushing for better conditions, a transformative EBA across the public education sector. Why are you here today? Can I ask you that?
Yeah. We're here to send a message to government that it's time to fully fund our schools, that it's time to put a decent offer to teachers, because the problems the profession is facing, the staff shortages, the pressure that staff are facing in schools, the exhaustion, the burnout, it's meaning that our students aren't being able to achieve their best, and ultimately that's what it's all about and that's what we want.
Yeah, and the last offer was considerably better than the previous offers, I'll have to say, because it was actually affecting the meeting loads and stuff like that, but and also giving some concern for the professional support staff, but it was still voted down. So a transformational EBA is what you want?
I think we need to have an EBA and a funding system that meets the needs of students and meets the needs of teachers. Members obviously felt the last offer didn't do that. I trust their judgment, and my hope is that our action today will encourage the government to see sense and to put something in place, both a funding model and an EBA that genuinely meets the needs of teachers, ES, school leaders and students.
Now there's been a lot of work towards getting to this stage. It's very brave of workers, isn't it, to be coming out again in a mass rally?
I think we are stronger together, both as individuals in our workplaces, as sub-branches and as a union, and today is both a celebration of that and a demonstration of our resolve that we should have a funding model that works and an EBA that meets the needs of staff, students and meets the expectations of the broader community in terms of what they want their public schools to look like.
Yeah, what are you doing here? Tell me why you're here.
Well, I shouldn't speak for my branch. I'm here because it's an unprecedented situation where a state Labor government has decided to go around our union. So for me, it's more about protest or lack of protest, what I believe to be doffing of the hat process with a Labor government. So while the conditions themselves aren't really good in terms of school funding, how dare a Labor government go around our union to set up my conditions? So as far as I'm concerned, they can go get
elaborate on that. Yeah, well, elaborate on that. Tell me about what you mean. Is that in relation to putting out a social media post saying it had all been accepted when it hadn't been?
No, we all received a vote that didn't go through negotiation with our union executive. We received a vote in our email. That was everybody, unionist and non-unionist. No problem with that. But they excluded the union executive from that discussion with that latest.
Oh, really?
Set of conditions, absolutely. And that has, in my memory, never been done before. And I've been through Kennett the whole lot. So that, to me, is a breach of confidence and trust with how a state Labor government should operate.
Why are you here?
We're here to try and get fully funded schools. So it's not just about, we hear a lot about the pay rise for teachers. It's not about the pay rise. This is not why we're here. It is about getting the resources for our schools to be able to give our kids the best education we can, which is currently what the Allan government is not doing.
Now, this is the second time you guys have had a mass rally. Last offer was considerably better than the previous one, but it was still voted down. I mean, you wouldn't have even got that second offer, basically, unless you'd come out in the streets. That's
what
I'm getting at.
Correct. But as I said, in the media, we hear a lot about the teacher pay and about how the teachers have rejected a pay offer. But what they're not telling you is in those offers that were given, there was nothing about giving additional funding to schools to supply for kids. Absolutely nothing. So, and that's why we're out here today, because it's really important that we have the resources to be able to give our kids. So I work in a school. I can tell you that we've had staff with broken arms that have been suffered from students. we have limited ES staff. It would be amazing to be able to have extra resources, to have extra staff to be able to assist with these kids. And that's ultimately what it is. We hear that, you know, Victoria's education state, but we are failing by not providing resources for these kids. The kids can't learn.
I've heard that you want a transformational EBA, a change, a big change.
A big change would be great, but really we need improvements in school funding. That's ultimately what we need.
What about the funding that they give to private schools?
Well, wouldn't it be nice if we could get that too? Why is the public supporting private schools? They're private schools. Public education is to give a free education to all Victorian students. So why are we funding private schools? Shouldn't our public education system be just as good, if not better, than a private school?
Setting the standard.
Yeah, it really should be. If we're providing a free education to our kids, why is it not at that standard? Why is it that they're having to fund private schools? They shouldn't be. So, you know, let's get some more funding for public education. That would be great.
Thanks very much.
Pleasure.
Oh, just protesting about the teachers, and I'm an ES staff, and we just want a pay rise. Yeah.
This is the second mass rally, and they did put a better offer.
Yeah.
It's obvious that rallying works.
Yeah, it does. It does. When we're all come together, and then schools close, and then the government might think and change and put a new offer in.
How long have you been working as an ES?
17 years.
Okay, and have you seen any changes that have been improvements?
A little bit, not a lot, but a little bit.
Okay, and so now this is both teachers and your group working together to get a result, isn't it? Because it's an industry union.
Correct, yeah, we are. We're trying to get a better offer.
Are a lot of your members here?
Not yet. They're taking the train up and they're coming down from the peninsula on their way up.
Thanks very much.
Thanks for that.
Do you want to tell me why you're here today?
Yeah, so I'm new to the teaching profession in the last 3 years, and I'm shocked at how much teachers are expected to work unpaid voluntarily.
Okay, so where did you come from?
I was in financial services, working here in the CBD.
Okay, and you wanted to give back to community, is that what?
Well, I think it's a case you get to a certain age and you know, one industry says it's time to move on, so I embraced teaching, and best decision I've ever made.
Okay, right. And so this is the second mass rally, and a better offer was put forward. But people are talking about needing a transformation in the EBA. Is that something why you're here today?
Oh, absolutely. So there comes a time. Throwing money at the problem isn't the answer. People want their lives back, and it's time to get some balance back in. So first things first, government offering 4 years smells of they want to stitch us up next time. 3 years is a better deal, it shows commitment to the long term. That and the fact that all they're doing is putting money on the table, not actually looking seriously at our working hours and our unpaid hours and cutting meetings by half. We're still at school, it doesn't save us anything. We need real time back in our lives and so do our families.
And so it sounds like the government doesn't really understand educational systems.
That's our impression. So we would encourage the negotiators to come and actually spend a day in our schools and our classrooms and then go back to the negotiating table. Just step into our lives for a moment, see the burdens we carry, see the work we put in for our students, inside and outside hours, and then have another think about our worth and the value we're bringing to community.
Now, one of the things that I've always wondered about is the amount of money that's given by government to private schools. I mean, I was actually educated in a private school, but so Catholic school, but people were expected to pay fees. It seems interesting to me that public schools are suffering while private schools are getting large slices of public money.
Yeah, look, I think that's a distraction from what we're here for. My kids also went to private school. I'm very happy with those choices. In this case, I want the best for all kids, and our state government has enough money to make it happen in the public system if they turn their mind to it.
Thank you.
Have a good day.
I'm wondering, can you tell me why you're here today?
I'm here today because I would like better conditions at work in terms of class sizes, reduction in workload. It's just overwhelming all the time.
Okay, and do you work, where do you work?
I work out in the north. Yeah.
Primary, secondary?
I'm primary, sorry. Yeah.
Okay, yeah. So it's right across the sector?
It's right across, yeah. I have friends in high school, in other schools around the state, and it's the same thing. I'm burnt out. I'm 40. And I'm ready to give up. My daughter is here with me today, and I don't know how long I can do this for. I just would like to be appreciated, like to be shown appreciation. Yeah.
And this is the second mass rally, and the last offer was slightly better than before. Mm-hmm. So obviously rallying works.
Yeah, it does. And I think it's shown that it's, people say, oh, it's all about the money. It's obviously not about the money, because we're here. It's obviously not about the money. You know, like, I'm at the top of the scale. That it's a significant improvement, but if it was about the money, everyone would have said yes. So
thanks very much.
Right, yes, I'm here because teachers need to be valued, principals need to be valued, education support staff need to be valued, and the government needs to start to listen to us and value us.
And now finally we're going to hear from a secondary teacher, Simon.
Friends, colleagues and comrades, it is a privilege and a pleasure to be here as part of this wonderful demonstration of union, of strength and of solidarity. My name is Simon and I work at a secondary school that serves a diverse and a disadvantaged community. Two-thirds of our students speak another language at home, and we have classrooms like so many here with many and complex needs in them. But we are a high-performing school thanks to our teachers, to our ES and our school leaders. The state government does not give us the funding that we need. So as teachers, as ES and as leaders, we are forced to triage. We have to make the hard decisions. And that means one thing, that student need goes unmet. Which means that our students are not equipped to do their best, and some disengage from their education. And I know, and you know, that that's mirrored all over the state. We know that that's not good enough. Is that good enough?
No!
Is that good enough?
No!
Staff at my school and all around the state know that proper funding will give us the time that we need to work with those that need it in class, to hire more inclusion aides so that every student can achieve, to restore the tutor program, to ensure that our learning spaces meet the learning needs of our students, and that we can provide the well-being support that every single one of our students needs. It will allow us to reduce our class sizes and, crucially, to grow the profession so that every child can achieve their best. Is that what we want?
Yes!
Because I want every child in the state to be able to have that light bulb moment in class when it all makes sense. And we are here waiting for the people in that building to have that light bulb moment and do what needs to be done. The lack of funding that we have means that us, AU members, have to step up and fill the gaps. We step up as therapists. We step up as behavioural psychologists. We step up as language teachers. We step up as mentors, as social coaches, as providers of food and drink and comfort and kindness and care, as well as being peer observers, educational researchers and dozens of other things. And my friends, it is exhausting. We feel it at the end of every day, at the end of every week, at the end of every month and at the end of every term and every year.
We're tired.
And it is not good enough, and we deserve better. Do we deserve better?
Yes!
Do we deserve better?
Yes!
Full funding means one thing, that we can put the student where they belong, at the centre, with their learning and their well-being. Staff and students deserve better from this government. It is public schools that do the heaviest lifting, and it is about time that this government recognise that. Until they do, we need to keep talking, keep recruiting, keep organising in our sub-branches, in our schools, in our communities, until we can get this done together. Because, my friends, take a moment and look around you. We are stronger together. So until the job is done, take care of yourselves, take care of each other, and keep fighting the good fight. Thank you.
Yeah.
And that was the AEU rally on Thursday, the Australian Education Union rally. We're coming to the end of the program. We're quick some events. Unite Against Racism, Broadmeadows Town Hall, 10 Dimboola Road, Broadmeadows, today at 2 p.m. Saturday. That's today.
And then later tonight at 6 p.m. you can come down to Democritus, 583 High Street, and we're having a celebration, we being Philef, about Pasta Shoot Antifascista, film screening, Cine Forum, and celebrating the anti-fascist uprising.
We're screening I Fratelli Cervi. If I just quick mention, there is an event on starting at 9 a.m. and finishing at 3 p.m., a mutual aid market to support. 100% of the funds are going to be raised directly to benefit First Nations and Palestinians. That is at Schoolhouse Studios at 28 Victoria Street, Coburg.
What day?
That's today.
Oh, yeah, cool.
Okay. There is live music and spoken word performances throughout the day.
Where is it at again?
At 28 Victoria Street, Coburg. It's just adjacent to a Coburg train station. The organisers actually recommend you go by public transport because the parking inspectors are quite vigilant. but there is parking at the front of the site.
And just quickly, 28th of July, that's Monday, 6:30 p.m, Kathleen Syme Library. There's public forum, artificial intelligence, capitalism and data centres. Interesting speakers, Digital Rights Watch, and academics from Melbourne University. There's also a 3CR fundraiser, Lost in Science Trivia Night at Birmingham Hotel, Smith Street, 7 p.m, 17th of August. We better get out.
That's it. And that's all for us. Going out with Jumble Up World by Kangaroos with a Cure?
I don't know.
Asia Pacific Currents up next.
Thank you.
heaven above. But a baby,
they're eyeing off an estate which is in perfectly good condition. It just happens to have bay views and a lot of open space.
Bay Views for All is a new documentary that reveals the human cost of the Victorian government's public housing redevelopment project. The film documents residents of the Barrack Beacon public housing estate as they fight to save their homes and community. Bay Views for All is available for community members, public housing advocates, and organizations to screen, intending to spark conversations, raise funds, and educate.